Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Monday, March 11th. It's been 4 days since President Biden's feisty State of the Union address. Between that and the Super Tuesday election results last week for him and Donald Trump, it is now almost fully general election season already, and it's only March 11th. But Trump has his legal issues to contend with, and Biden has ongoing and perhaps growing dissatisfaction with his role in the war in Gaza. On Weekend Edition yesterday, for the first day of Ramadan, they played this clip of a Palestinian-American from San Francisco named Marwan Sabeta, who is beginning the daily fasting ritual, but thinking about his relatives back in central Gaza.
They will not have a meal. So it shattered me. When I eat, when it's time to break my fast, I'll be taking bites with a great deal of pain, sorrow, suffering, agony, and consumed with guilt.
And as for President Biden, he didn't get to Gaza until an hour into his State of the Union address. And while he talked in some tougher language than before about the Netanyahu government and humanitarian aid, it's still a joint Netanyahu-Biden war because Biden will not threaten to end the military funding over when he objects to the way in which the war is being carried out. So here's Biden on MSNBC yesterday with an example of that, as the host Jonathan Capehart asks Biden if he has any red line regarding continued military support.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you have a red line? For instance, would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if he crosses and they cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going after.
Bottom line, no red line as far as we could tell. The military aid will continue to flow, enabling the war on Netanyahu's terms, no matter what words Biden speaks to the world. With me now on the presidential campaign today is Susan B. Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker, where she writes a weekly column on news from Washington. Susan also has deep journalistic international affairs experience as editor of Foreign Policy magazine, 4 years as the Washington Post's Moscow Bureau chief, covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and is the author of the books Kremlin Rising, The Man Who Ran Washington, and most recently The Divider, the best-selling history of Donald Trump in the White House, which she co-wrote with her husband, Peter Baker, from the New York Times. Susan, always good to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian. Great to be with you.
For people who see the war in Gaza as having become an atrocity, whether or not they use the word genocide, Biden might have sounded pretty mealy-mouthed there when asked about a red line for conditioning military aid, even as he denounces some of how the war is being fought. Why won't his actions match his increasingly critical language based on your reporting?
Well, look, I mean, it was I found it confusing as well to figure out exactly what he was saying. I mean, it's clear in the last few weeks, Brian, that we've been seeing an increasing public distancing between Biden, his administration, and the Netanyahu government. He's placed in just this incredibly awkward position, politically speaking, of course, because he had the notion from the very beginning of publicly supporting Israel while privately using that as leverage to sort of influence the shape of the conflict. And unfortunately, there's not much evidence, especially in recent weeks, that he has the leverage that he might have anticipated from taking that public stance. And politically speaking, he and Netanyahu's interests now have really diverged. Netanyahu, of course, is wildly unpopular in his own country. He has yet to face accountability for his own actions that, you know, led in many ways to the horror of October 7th, and there's a clear sense that if there were to be an election in Israel, he would be thrown out. So he has this, unfortunately, this political interest in prolonging the conflict at exactly the moment when Biden is increasingly urgent in his desire to push it to come to some kind of an end, or at least a long-term ceasefire. So it's really a mess, obviously.
Yeah. But Biden said in the clip that a red line, at least in his mind, would be the planned assault on Rafah. But is there anything to indicate that Netanyahu won't just go in when and how he pleases? Because Biden's role seems to be, I don't know, maybe we would say just another lobbyist, even though we're the key funders of the operation, or among the key funders of the operation.
Well, again, we don't know what we don't know and what's happening behind the scenes. There's an interesting question about why he hasn't already done that despite threatening it for a long time. There is the question of whether negotiations with Hamas on release of the additional hostages and a ceasefire of whatever duration, have those completely broken down? Is this part of the posturing related to that? That's one question that I have right now. Of course, there's a great urgency, it seems to me, putting aside the politics of this. You have the terrible situation of the ongoing and escalating human catastrophe inside Gaza, as well as, the hostages who've been there for so long at this point. So my guess is that that still takes a priority in terms of American diplomacy in the region. I just wish that there was some kind of a breakthrough that we're not seeing. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened. And once again, Biden was caught out. Remember, right before the Michigan primary, he said he expected there to be a ceasefire deal within the next week. That by last Monday, that did not happen. Once again, embarrassing the president of the United States, it seems to me.
Right. And I know those are very difficult negotiations where both Israel and Hamas feel like if the ceasefire takes place on some specific terms versus others, it's going to disadvantage one side or the other too much. And so those are complex negotiations. But even in the president's language, thinking about the State of the Union address, and you were just describing, as of course everybody knows, the extent of the catastrophe in Gaza at this point. There was an article on Vox where somebody described it as an era-defining catastrophe. And it does seem like the kind of thing that's going to be remembered for a long, long time to come and affect, obviously the families there, but also regional politics for a long, long time to come. But even in the State of the Union address, in his language, he started the speech with a fierce urgency of helping Ukraine. But Gaza, with 30,000 dead in 5 months, funded by us, and he cited that statistic. So he seemed to confirm the Hamas statistic on the number of dead, but he shunted it off to the last few minutes of the speech, and he lectured Netanyahu to fight differently while feeding him billions to continue. But what did you think about the placement of that in the speech relative to Ukraine?
Yeah, well, I think I wouldn't make false equivalences, that's for sure. I these are very different and both urgent crises. The scale of the deaths is astonishing and horrible in Gaza. It is also now a number of years into the war in Ukraine, and we're looking at enormous scale of deaths that's actually much greater. Let's just hope and pray that the conflict and the fighting does not go on anywhere near that long in Gaza. The politics are very different for the president, and I think his view is that probably the stakes for the geopolitical order are somewhat different as well. And he was making a political point with Republicans in Congress who, for basically more than 6 months, have, at the word of Donald Trump, held up billions of dollars in promised U.S. military assistance to Ukraine. And I think that, he was seeing this as really a last chance to push for that kind of assistance before the crisis on the ground in the war in Ukraine becomes really acute. We're talking again about millions and millions of people displaced. We're talking about tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, dead in this conflict. We are talking about Ukraine and the sort of existential question about whether that country can continue to hold out without the United States' promised military assistance. Again, the president's credibility as a sort of superpower is directly on the line, as is that of the United States as well. So again, you know, are we capable of sort of processing two foreign policy crises at once? I mean, that's one of the reasons I think, frankly, there is a crisis of confidence in the world about the United States, which does not seem to be able to deliver on its commitments anymore because of our own internal political divisions.
What did you think about the placement of Ukraine right at the top of the speech as compared to things that are more domestic? From a political analysis standpoint, Ukraine is probably not the number one thing on most Americans' minds, no matter what you and I may think of the urgency of not letting Ukraine fall to Putin, but not the number one thing on most Americans' minds. But Biden started with that, and later he got to inflation and other domestic matters. What do you make of it?
I mean, look, what he was doing in the speech, and I think this will be a theme that you will hear throughout the reelection campaign, is connecting our own domestic political crises and the threat posed to the United States by sort of Trump and his MAGA movement with a broader international context. And so that's the way in which he was talking about the war in Ukraine, not in an abstract way, but I think very much connected with the idea that reelecting a president, Donald Trump, who is an open admirer of people like Vladimir Putin, and in fact would essentially force an end to the U.S. policy of assisting Ukraine, that there's a connection between the internal threats to democracy, a president like Trump who would essentially both go against the Constitution at home and also be an admirer. He's called Vladimir Putin a strategic genius the same week as Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago. So I think that's the context in which Biden was attempting to open his speech. And I think, as we both know, this is a core belief of Biden's, and so we'll be hearing a lot more about it.
Lloyd in Woodbridge, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lloyd.
Yeah, hi, Brian. So I think Biden is being criticized unfairly for his position with Gaza. Short of withholding military aid, what can he do? He doesn't run the Israeli government. And contrast that with Trump, how he denigrated Palestinians during his administration. So I think he's between a rock and a hard place, and I think he's trying to be tough, but he can't politically withhold aid. And outside of that, what can he do? That's my point.
Lloyd, thank you. Susan, do you want to answer the question as he asked it?
Yeah, I think that certainly the Lloyd's point is very reflective of what the analysis of the president and his administration is right now, you know, politically essentially caught between two very conflicting and competing imperatives. What I thought was very interesting that last week, senior administration officials played host to Benny Gantz, who is basically Netanyahu's chief opposition in many ways in the elections to come. We don't know when exactly. That was a very pointed message they were looking to send to Israelis. You know, Biden was caught on a open mic at the State of the Union talking to Senator Michael Bennett and basically saying he was fed up with Netanyahu and he was planning to have a, quote, come to Jesus conversation with the Israeli leader. I'm surprised. It's interesting to see how much criticism. I understand the criticism coming from many parts of the progressive pro-Palestine left in the United States to Biden, but in the context of the U.S. election, Donald Trump was probably the most flamboyantly supportive of Netanyahu of any leader we've had, essentially turned over American policy in the region and to Netanyahu in a way that we've never seen any president, Democrat or Republican, do. And it's really interesting to me that the critics of Biden from within his own coalition haven't focused on the lack of a meaningful alternative in Trump. It's quite remarkable in this election year.
Have you been covering Trump on this point? Is he, it's, from the little I've seen, it seems to me that he's trying to lay low on this issue, and he's not saying explicitly how he would be different from Biden or how he would be the same as Biden in supporting Israel in the war in Gaza as it's being fought.
Well, there's one big difference, Brian, which is that Donald Trump, like Netanyahu, is not really a supporter of the two-state solution. There's just no question about that. You know, it's interesting. I agree with you that politically politically Trump, I imagine, sees advantage in having Biden's own coalition be mad at him. So he doesn't want to get in between that internal argument to a large extent. Also, as we reported in the Divider, people might have missed the fact that Trump really got personally angry with Netanyahu in the final year of his administration, and in particular after the 2020 election. Why? Because Netanyahu called up Biden and congratulated him on his victory over Donald Trump in 2020. Trump turns American foreign policy into an instrument of his own policy. And so, you know, with Donald Trump, everything is personal. So there is the element of basically still holding a grudge against Netanyahu for recognizing Biden's victory. But, you know, look, we did an entire chapter on our book devoted to what was Trump's and his son-in-law Jared Kushner's record with Israel in the Middle East, and it's quite a forgotten story, it seems to me. You know, our collective amnesia around what Trump did when he was in the White House is pretty amazing to me.
On the caller from Woodbridge's other point, saying that politically, Biden can't cut off military aid to Israel. Do you think that's true? I mean, is there a sort of political calculus in Biden's mind? I mean, he seems to have strong beliefs of his own that applies to Ukraine as well as, you know, as well as the politics. But what do you think about a political calculus here? You think the Biden campaign is looking at, well, the pro-Israel and, you know, don't cut it off no matter what Netanyahu does, lobby, where, you know, we get commenters all the time saying, hey, this is AIPAC flexing its muscles versus the pressure from the progressive left within the Democratic coalition. That is there a power struggle there that Biden is, you know, at least according to the caller there, who's a Biden supporter, who thinks Biden is acting fairly and rationally, just too weighted in one direction?
Well, again, I mean, the premise suggests that there's some difference between a political calculation by the president and what he actually thinks. I mean, it seems to me in this instance, Brian, Biden's political instincts and his personal policy instincts converge here. It would be very hard, and he is at core a supporter of Israel for decades and its right to exist. I don't think that makes him or anyone an uncritical supporter of Israel, right? And in this situation, what we've heard very clearly from the administration is increasing frustration and even anger towards Netanyahu, but a set of questions around what are they really going to do? What are viable alternatives for them? I have heard from my sources in the administration, in the White House, in the State Department, a sense that this is really Biden himself dictating the constraints and the contours of the policy here and the response. My guess is that it was a different Democratic president in office. You might have not had such full-throated and fulsome backing of Israel and Netanyahu at the very beginning of the war. But again, you know, right now, what you hear very loudly and clearly from them is they're willing to consider things that they weren't willing to consider even a few weeks earlier. So, you know, we'll see where this goes. I thought that the announcement that they would go ahead and build an emergency pier off of Gaza to provide humanitarian aid, essentially acknowledging that they needed to bypass the blockade of their own ally. Yes. That was a remarkable difference in tone from the administration.
The headline on your post State of the Union article in The New Yorker was, "So much for Sleepy Joe, Biden's rowdy, shouty State of the Union. Is it too early here 4 days later to know if it served the political purpose of countering the fears of Democrats and swing voters that he's not up to the job anymore?"
Well, I'll be interested to see, as I'm sure you will, whether this speech, which got basically good reviews among those it was aimed at, Republicans didn't like it. It wasn't a speech aimed at Republicans. It seemed to me that it was a speech that was aimed at wavering Democrats and independents who might vote Democratic, to reassure them that that Biden was really up to the job of a second term, that he was in the fight. And I will be looking to see whether that has any tangible and lasting effect on the polls and on Biden standing there. What's been striking to me up until now has been the real immutability of the polls. And, you know, last year as well, in 2023, Biden had a pretty well-regarded State of the Union, and it made no lasting political difference on his standing. If anything, he came into the 2024 State of the Union worse by most metrics in terms of his standing. Democrats just haven't consolidated and rallied round their standard bearer to the extent to which Republicans have consolidated around Donald Trump. So that's what I'll be looking for.
And you wrote, and this will be the last question, that you couldn't remember a single case of the State of the Union rescuing a troubled presidency. Did you have any particular comparisons in mind?
Well, I mean, that's what's notable, right? I mean, these speeches generally are sort of very forgettable, certainly as rhetoric and as pieces of writing. You know, I've watched many, many of them over the last few decades, Brian, and I can't quote a lot of memorable lines or insights from them. I think it's a moment along the way. And that's the problem for Biden this year. There's many downsides to big appearances like this, right? Like one stumble, a series of gaffes that could be really politically damaging to him. But at the same time, it's hard to see where he gets the upside, where he breaks through in a positive way. So that's really, I think, what we'll be seeing. But did he manage to reassure his own constituency heading into this very long general election campaign?
Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker, where she writes a weekly column on Biden's Washington. Her most recent book with her husband, Peter Baker, from The New York Times, is called The Divider, a best-selling history of Donald Trump in the White House. Susan, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.